Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. What happens when you get the call? Your mother or father, your spouse or child has had an accident or been diagnosed with a life-changing or life-threatening disease, and you are the person they're looking to. You're the one that's got to help them out. Gail Sheehy is the author of 15 books, including Passages. It remained on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years and has been reprinted in 28 languages. In that book and others chronicling the life cycles of baby boomers, she has told us to find our passions and revive our old dreams. But in her latest book, she provides a how-to guide to those among us who get the call instead. Welcome to the show, Gail.
I'm so glad to be here, Ann.
You are going to be giving a presentation that'll include a Q&A. It is hosted by the Transition Network. If folks want to go to WOSU.org/all sides, we'll have a link to that and more information. Gail, the book is heavily woven from your own experience with your husband, Clay Felker, the founder and editor of New York Magazine, as he struggled with cancer and all the ancillary ailments. How did you decide, in the midst of all that, and I know you're a journaler, but how did you decide there's a book here?
Well, I had to write journals to keep myself sane because so many bizarre things happen, and we have such a fractured medical system that you really have to figure out this whole foreign country and its new language on your own. So I found that very therapeutic. But then I was actually asked to be the caregiving ambassador to AARP. And they sent me around the country to interview caregivers in different stages of the journey. And I did that actually 6 weeks after my husband died. I was on the road, which was really very helpful to me. And most caregivers feel alone, and they become solitary, and then they don't take care of themselves, and then they're very likely to get sick. We're not alone. The first thing I learned was there are nearly 50 million of us taking care of an adult who used to be independent. That's not even counting disabled children. And there's so much out there that we don't know about. I keep finding it as I'm on the road. I find out more and more of what's available to help us, help give caregivers respite time to go away, and even financial resources. So after interviewing everybody else, I actually sat down to say, okay, what is this whole journey like? And it came to me as I was walking around a labyrinth on a caregiver retreat. You're in a labyrinth. You're walking around in circles. Suddenly you come on these abrupt twists and turnings that come out of nowhere. Sometimes you double back and you're back where you started from and you say, wait a second, this feels like caregiving. This is just what it's like. But just like caregiving, there is one path, and it will eventually take you to the center of the labyrinth. And in my way of thinking, in the labyrinth of caregiving, that's where you have to come to terms with, is your loved one going to come back? Or is likely to become more and more needy and dependent. And if so, then you have to begin preparing another path for yourself to come back before you lose them. Otherwise, you're left with a hole.
Sometimes in the labyrinth, you're forced to go backwards before you go forward.
That's right. But you're going back to a stage that you've been to before because you've had a boomerang. The old illness has come back, or there's another health crisis, or there's a reaction to treatment. But you know it better now, and you should know by now not to take the first consult with the doctor if you don't like the way that treatment is going, even if it leaves you high and dry. One time we were left for, a whole weekend where we thought the only choice was to have my husband's voice box removed, and he said he'd rather die. So we put out calls to friends, people who knew doctors, hospitals, other caregivers who'd taken care of somebody with cancer. And within 48 hours, we had an appointment with another oncologist at Mass General in Massachusetts who had a whole different protocol, and it was able to save my husband's voice.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gail Sheehy. She is the author of Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. You know, some of the statistics that you noted in the book were shocking. You mentioned 50 million caregivers out there. In almost one-third of American households, somebody is serving in an unpaid caregiver role. What else do we know about them?
Well, the average age of a caregiver is a woman in her late 40s who still has at least one child at home and is working. So she has her own family to take care of. The most important thing, I think, is to have the conversation with your siblings before the crisis. before you have to suddenly, you know, scramble for doctors and go onto Google and freak out because of all the, you know, scary statistics they give you. We like to think that siblings would be the biggest help, but actually they're often the biggest stress because old roles come up and who was the favorite and who left home early and didn't take responsibility. So if you have a conversation before the crisis and say to your siblings, you know, mom and dad are getting older, they're going to need help at some point. What are we all going to be able to do? Let's email and say, this is what I'm best at. You know, somebody in the family may be a lawyer. They can read the fine print in the insurance policy or the Medicare regulations. Somebody else is a social worker and knows how to hire people on the outside. There's a couple of, you know, new players you have to get to know about. There's a geriatric care manager. If everybody lives distant from mom and dad, a geriatric care manager is a social worker or a nurse or somebody trained in social work, and they can actually take over for you, and you can give them permission to, you know, contact doctors if there's an emergency. They can put together a team, and if you they are for a fee, but even in the first weeks of a health crisis, if you have a geriatric care manager do an assessment of the needs of your mom and then the caregiver at home, maybe it's dad, they can walk you through the shortcuts and tell you how to protect your own assets before you get into trouble. And if you only spend 3 or 4 hours, it'll save you so much trouble with bureaucratic brush-offs and dead ends.
You know, you're talking about the bureaucratic brush-offs and dead ends, and then there's the finances. I mean, there's this whole emotional layer of you have a loved one or maybe somebody that stressed you out your entire life, but you're still with their caregiver because of the relationship.
Right, I talk about the unloved one.
Yeah.
Take care of the unloved one.
Which is interesting. And then there's the financial part of it, the stress. And we hear it all the time about people going into – they can't pay make their mortgage payments anymore because of the hospital payments. And They're afraid they won't get the same kind of treatment if they don't pay their doctor's bills. And then just the whole long-term care crisis.
Well, you know, the first thing to find out, and an elder care attorney can help you with this. That's another player you need to know about. Maybe your loved one qualifies for Medicaid, which has very generous benefits for the caregiver as well. You know, there's income parameters. The person can only have $2,000 of countable assets per month. But the spouse who is responsible for the medical debts of a partner can have over $100,000 in assets and a home worth up to $750,000. So it's not – Medicaid is not just for poor people. But the important thing is that under Medicare, if your loved one is over 65, there is a federal benefit which offers respite for caregivers up to 4 and 5 times in the course of a year. And by that I mean you can take your family member to a hospice residence or to a hospital that has a palliative care or hospice unit, leave them there under good care for 4 or 5 days and get away to a wedding or a graduation or a family vacation of your own, which you need 4 or 5 times a year. That's essential, that and taking care of yourself, doing something pleasurable at least 1 hour a day, every single day. It breaks the cycle of hypervigilance. It breaks that cycle of stress hormones. Otherwise, you're going to use up all those hormones, and you won't have anything left. You'll be running on empty. And then there's nobody to take care of the person. The problem with these wonderful respite benefits is that most caregivers don't take advantage of them because they think they can't leave. And then eventually they get sick themselves, and then they need the respite to get an operation or help themselves.
Getting sick yourself is very common,
right,
among caregivers.
Right. And it is preventable, and it's predictable. Sure, I got there. I didn't get physically sick, but I went into depression at one point. I certainly went into, you know, hyper agitation, where you can't think straight because, you know, those stress hormones make you stupid. You can't make good decisions. And I had to learn how to meditate. I went to a 12-step program to help me stop playing God. That's one of the biggest dangers of all. You begin to think if you're really good at this and you're taking charge and, you know, you're winning and things are falling into place and you see mistakes that you've averted, you begin to think you are the only one saving this person from, you know, disaster or death day by day. So that's fine as long as things are going well and you're winning. And then something goes wrong. It's not your fault. You know, the disease comes back, the treatment backfires, or you get a medication conflict. Well, if you're God, then you're going to think it's your fault. And then you have that whole cascade of guilt. Well, it's not your fault. You're doing probably more than you ever thought you could or would. So once you start accepting there is a God, if you believe in God, but you're not it. None of us can control aging or the trajectory of an illness. And nobody can do this alone. Nobody. It's not humanly possible. So I talk a lot in the book about how to create a circle of care. First, starting with the doctors and nurses and social workers, and how to find a medical quarterback. You know, you talk to a lot of doctors at the beginning of a health crisis, and they all have a slightly or sometimes a contradictory approach. You don't know how to sort this out. So I say, ask the doctor that you trust the most three questions. Will you help us choose among the care options? Will you help us put together the care team and the care plan? And will you deal with pain or other side effects of the treatment? And if you get one doctor who will agree to being on board for those, you found yourself a medical quarterback who'll help you call the plays and assemble the team. Then you may also want a geriatric care manager. But that's where you start. And then you want to assemble a personal team. And you do that by maybe asking your best friend to, here's a novel idea, throw a caregiver shower. You know, when we come home from the hospital with a newborn, friends always give us a shower, and then everybody is alerted to the fact, you know, you're going to be needing some help and some calls, and also gives you lots of nice things to feel good. Well, you're bringing somebody home from the hospital as a caregiver. And maybe it's long distance, and maybe you're in your mom's or dad's hometown, and you don't know their neighbors, so get to know their neighbors. Find out their best friend and see if she'll give a caregiving shower for her friend, and bring nice things for the person who's coming home, nice things for you. And then everybody gets alerted that this is a time where you need to be, you know, eyes on the people.
We have to take a short break. My guest is Gail Sheehy. She is the author of Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook. We'll be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Hi, we're Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. You know, a lot of people consider themselves automotive experts.
I had this theory that it put all the strain on the alternator from the battery and...
Kelly,
stop. You're hanging yourself.
Stop.
It's getting embarrassing now.
It was a great idea, but give it up.
Why not run your theories by us and 5 million other listeners, too?
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk tomorrow at noon on WOSU. NPR News and Classical Music. 25 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today, a high near 30. Clouds tonight, and a low right around 11 degrees. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gail Sheehy. She is the author of Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. She's going to be speaking. If you'd like more information, go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link to that and more information. I guess, you know, eventually my experience and the experience of so many Americans now because of our healthcare system is that it comes down to money. But we know most of us don't have enough money
right.
to take care of it anyway. But you have I'm not sure it's a chapter, but it's a section in the book that talks about follow the money. And
yeah.
When you bring somebody to a hospital after they've fallen or had some kind of mishap, mm-hmm. they're already in the decline, and they stick them in the hospital and they start doing the tests.
Right.
This is not a mystery to you anymore why this happens.
No, and that's the way the payment system is set up. The hospitals get a lump sum payment from Medicare for each hospital admission, and it's based on the diagnosis. So if the diagnosis is 3 days for uncomplicated pneumonia, if the person stays for 5 days, the hospital loses money. So they're anxious to get you out sooner. They're anxious to get you in as many times as possible because each time they get the payment, and to get you out as soon as possible. And every test, of course, adds to their fee. And every time the doctor looks in through the green curtains and says, hello, Mrs. Jones, the doctor gets
even if you have to wait 6 hours for them to stick their head through the curtain.
Right. And even if they don't do any tests that day or any real exam. So, you know, eventually, particularly with elderly people or people with chronic illness, which most illnesses develop into today as people get into their high 70s, 80s, or 90s, you don't want them to go back to the hospital every time because there are all kinds of creepy crawly things. They come home with a new virus, Pseudomonas, one of the resistant viruses, or they also stay in bed for a long time and they don't get moved because most hospitals now consider physical therapy a frill. So unless you bring in your own, weights and Dynabands to stretch and, give some muscle workout, people are going to become more and more debilitated, and then they finally can't walk. So my solution, when we became what I call medical refugees, my husband could no longer be cured of recurrent pneumonia in an acute care hospital, but he was a long way from hospice. So what I discovered was palliative care. And palliative care is for before hospice. And it can happen from the time of a life-threatening illness diagnosis. It can happen years before, when the first time you hear that your loved one has Parkinson's, for instance. Palliative care, progressive palliative care programs, such as you have in Cleveland, will send a home care team. So you can take care of the person at home and prevent emergencies from requiring going to the ER. You'll get a doctor who works out a care plan with you, the caregiver and the patient, and puts the power back in the hands of the patient to make the decisions based on their goals for this time of life. You know, my husband was asked with a house call from a palliative care doctor, Clay, what makes it important for you to get up every morning? What do you need for a quality of life? And he said, I'm a journalist. I need to go out in the world and see what's going on, no matter what it takes, no matter if it's in a wheelchair. So we made that first priority. I want to walk again. And the doctor was able to say, we can do the first priority, but you probably won't be able to walk independently again, but we can certainly make it possible for you to go anywhere, either on a walker or with a wheelchair, and we'll do that. Also asked him, what would be a kind of life that you wouldn't want to live any longer. So then you know how to guide the caregiver and the doctor to what kind of treatment somebody doesn't want. Would they want a feeding tube? My husband actually had a feeding tube for 10 years because we learned how to deal with it and how to go out and eat with it. But that's the whole reason that palliative care can keep somebody more comfortable, safer. They can still have aggressive treatment at home, even chemo if it makes them more comfortable. There's also a nurse practitioner who comes to visit regularly and catches anything that looks like it's going in a bad direction so you can take care of it at home. A social worker who is a great support for the family, just like they are in hospice, helping you to know what the next stage is like and how to read symptoms, and possibly a pastoral counselor and a music and art therapist if they're supported by philanthropy. And then eventually the patient will seamlessly go on to hospice when it looks like there's only 6 months to live. And then there's even more benefits, which come all free. So it's something that people need to know about because so many of us get stuck in this in-between stage and then don't take advantage of hospice until the last weeks or even the last days before the end of life.
We're going to take a call right now. Brenda, you're on the air with Gail Sheehy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I want to make sure I get all of this in order because there's so much involved. My dad abused me when I was growing up, but out of four children, I was the only one who got this stuff. Mm-hmm. And he is deeply in the throes of Alzheimer's, and I have become his prime caregiver. it's just absolutely crazy because very few times do my sibs step in for anything. I wanted to tell you that the doctors advised us for a long time that he was becoming a safety issue, living at home alone.
Mm-hmm.
Two doctors and three nurses. Well, we could not get the man out of his house, and he was, you know, he was just crazy. He was calling me and telling me we had to get my dad or my mom safe, who's been dead for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got really, really bad, we thought we were going to have to call the police to check in on him. I had to rush around and find a place for him, go home, and it was just nuts.
So
what, in the car.
Where is it at right now, Brenda?
Well, excuse me, I'm sorry. Right now, I say I'm his prime caregiver, and I am bipolar. So I am handling all of the issues involved with this man because I was appointed.
Is he on Medicaid? Is he on Medicaid?
No, he had a little bit of money in the bank, and we're in the process of selling his personal and real estate.
Well, you don't even have to, as long as he's staying in his home right now, you don't have to sell it to qualify him for going to a nursing home. And it sounds like it's essential that he be in a safe place so that you're not distressed and he isn't going to be, in danger.
He is. We put him into an assisted living facility. Mm-hmm. You know, slash nursing
right.
home. I mean, to get him down here, the things that we had to tell him and to do for him, like I say, were just craziness. He was, for me, I mean, I had to have days and days where I had did nothing but work on his files.
Can I just suggest that you don't play God? You know, your father is in a stage of mental illness that makes him not rational. You can't deal with him. But the people at the assisted living are trained to do that. You can go off the job for some of every day and maybe, you know, need to go away for a vacation. But let other people who are professionals take care of your dad and you take care of yourself because you sound really, really on the edge.
Yes, I am. I am very close to another breakdown. I have had two nervous breakdowns. But
well, then you need care. You need to get yourself to a doctor and care for yourself.
Right.
You can't have two people go down for one.
Right, right. Well, the problem, I guess the main problem is that I get no support from my siblings.
Well, if that's the case, then, you know, then you need to get support for yourself.
Okay. Brenda,
right.
You hearing her?
Yeah.
You need help. And
I do.
We all do in that kind of a situation.
Yeah, I know.
And
I just, like you said, I just keep trying to handle it by myself, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Gail, isn't it true that the nursing home or the assisted living, they have a social worker there? They know of a social worker? They can connect you with somebody? Do you have anybody like that, Brenda?
You know, we've been through all of this procedure. I'm sitting here listening to you talk on the radio, and we've been through it all.
So you have a social worker.
Workers, doctors, nurses.
Yeah.
I mean, I dragged the man over the whole state of Ohio trying to get him good health care.
It sounds like what Gail said, so I appreciate your call.
Good luck, and please stop playing God.
Take care, Brenda.
Okay, bye.
Hang in there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The playing God thing is a big problem.
Yes, it is.
And the letting go thing, too.
And letting go, yeah. And each person has to find their way and time to let go. But very often it's the family members or one family member who wants to hang on longer. And it's very likely to be the one who was the most distant during the whole caregiving phase and now, you know, comes dashing in at the end and says, no, 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 we have to do this. We haven't tried that. And to assuage their own guilt, wants to keep everything going. And this may be really miserable for the patient. You know, you have to really try to assess the patient's own wishes. I have to tell you that my husband, who, as I say, had a feeding tube for 10 years, and we found out how to eat in restaurants, I would just go to the manager or the chef in the afternoon and show them the blender and the strainer and the whole process and ask if they would be willing in advance to liquefy a meal so that my husband and I could enjoy the romantic ambiance of the restaurant and sit in a discreet place and have dinner, often with friends. They always agreed. Well, at the end, near the end of his life, which he prolonged for way beyond what anybody thought was possible, he pulled out the feeding tube. And as soon as I saw that, I asked him if that was an accident. He said, oh, yes, it was an accident. But it wasn't. And the doctor told me, don't ask him. Don't keep asking him, because a husband can't tell his wife that he's ready to let go, because that's saying, I'm going to leave you alone. And one of the things that people are most afraid of, particularly spouses, is what's going to happen to my wife and my husband when I'm gone. So I had to say, are you ready to go? And then I elicited from him that he was afraid for me. And I said, I'll be okay. I have all of our friends, and you're part of all of them, and they'll give me part of you. So I'm ready when you are. And then we were able to go out a couple of nights before he died and go to a jazz club.
I read him.
And he was, beating on the table and drumming as he did as a boy to the jazz music. We had a wonderful time. But that's because I let him, give the signal as to when he was ready.
One of the physicians told you at one point, you're saying, isn't there a point where they got to quit working on him all the time? And he
right.
said, well, actually, this is a reflection of your relationship with your husband. They see how tight you two are.
Right.
They think there's a big, strong life force there still that you want.
That's right. We became such devoted partners and did beat cancer 4 times, believe it or not. So the doctors kept pulling out another rabbit from the hat until finally a very candid doctor came to me and said, after my husband had been hospitalized repeatedly for pneumonias that he couldn't prevent because he kept aspirating from his throat. And finally, this doctor said, your husband has entered the cycle of slow dying. I said, what is that? How long does that take? And he said, well, he could live another year or two like this. I said, I don't know if I can take that. And he said, what's the alternative? I said, can't you tell me? And he said, well, the next time he gets pneumonia, don't bring him to the hospital. That sounded kind of brutal at the time, but it was exactly right, because it's what we were talking about before, Anne. Every time you bring somebody to the emergency room, then they wait for hours, they probably pick up more viruses, then they're checked in, then the hospital gets paid, the doctor gets paid, they poke and probe and do all the tests all over again, make the person miserable, send them home more debilitated, and then you just make those rounds through the revolving door over and over and over again for every time they fall, every time they get a fever or congested heart failure or what. You can operate from home, and more progressive palliative care teams and even progressive hospice teams are taking care of people for longer at home with a lot of support for the family and for the patient.
We have a call right now from Tom. Tom, you have a personal experience you want to share about being a caregiver to somebody who suffered with HIV/AIDS. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and I'll be very brief, but there are two things that occur to me. One, I was taking my friend back and forth to the medical appointments, and his situation was ever worse. And, you try to put on the brave face and be supportive and so on and so forth. But there was a particular day, we'd always go to lunch afterwards, and there was a particular day where the news just absolutely wasn't good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having lunch, and I asked for the salt and pepper or something stupid. And I just started crying. I said, you're doing awfully good with this. And he said, Tom, I know my answers are usually going to be bad at this stage.
Mm.
And I said, well, I feel so guilty being upset. And he said, oh, honey, when you love somebody, you're going through the same disease they are. You just don't,
That's right.
You don't feel it. You're feeling the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a relief for me. And one of the things that I told people, when you're going through this, laugh when you feel like laughing, cry when you feel like crying, and mm-hmm. scream when you feel like screaming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Get in the car, turn up the music loud so nobody can hear you, and just drive around and scream for 20 minutes.
Well, and the other thing, and I suppose this presents a bias, but when he was in the hospital, he asked me, had I brought his do not resuscitate order.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I mean, I'll do it. He said, well, there's no hurry. He said, later, he said, I knew if I told you no hurry, you'd have it there in a heartbeat. But his response to me was just lovely. He said, you know, if God's kind enough to send me a stroke or a heart attack, I'd hate to miss out on it on a technicality. So that's my comments. I honor
your
sharing of information. It's so desperately needed.
Oh, thank you for sharing with us.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That is an interesting point that he made, and it's one that you make in the book, that you're going through the same thing emotionally.
Absolutely. Emotionally, ups and downs. And caregivers almost all feel guilty. But you know what? We almost all, if we're on the ride for a long time, get to the turning I call, I can't do this anymore. Even Rosalind Carter, who is, you know, just the soul of goodness, told me that she took care of her mother for years while they were in the White House and after the White House. And then when her brother got sick and she had to be the caregiver again, she just threw up her hands and said, I can't do this anymore. Well, she did, but she said, there's no reason to feel guilt because you're doing so much more than, you know, just to have a caregiver is a huge gift. A lot of people don't have anybody. So one of the things I talk about is you have to prepare your own comeback before you begin actually in going into the last stages of somebody's life. Because, you know, what were your joys? What gave you joy before you got into this role? What are your outlets? Who are friends that you haven't, you know, connected with? You go into isolation, people stop calling you because you're not available. You have to start seeing them again, you know. Have a party for yourself and say, I need to see my friends. Can you all come? Because I don't have much time. I'd love to see you all. Go back to a sport that you played. Start journaling. Every day, do something for at least an hour. Take a yoga class. Go for a walk. Go to the library and read a book where nobody can bother you for a while. I used to lie on my back and put my legs up on the wall and listen to, you know, meditation music and meditate for an hour. And it would just slow down my heart rate and put me in a different frame of mind. And then go away. Go away for a long weekend, or if you can afford the money, go to a health spa for a week and take care of yourself. I met two women on a hike at a health spa that I finally went to after 5 years of nonstop caregiving. They were both in their 40s, and one of them, mother, was already in the hospital with a morphine drip. And she was, at the last moment, she almost canceled this trip because the hospice people said, where are the burial plans for your mother? You can't go away without giving them because what if she died? She couldn't find them. So finally, she went to see her mom. Her eyes were at half mast. She was under morphine. She said, Mom, you know how I love you. I've been with you every day. And now I'm just so wiped out. I need to go away, take care of myself for a week. I'm going to be in Mexico. So don't die. And Mom's eyes flew open and she came back to life. And she said, honey, that's what I want for you. Go. And for that brief moment, Mom was Mom again and daughter was daughter again. And she was returning the gift of caregiving to her own daughter. That was a precious moment. And when that young woman came back, her mother had gotten an infection, and she had to stay up with her day and night for the last 3 weeks of her life. She would never have been able to do that with good heart and good mind if she hadn't taken care of herself for that week.
We have to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation with Gail Sheehy, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to All Sides Facebook page as well, All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
He hunted elephants with Teddy Roosevelt, killed a leopard with his bare hands, and then stuffed them. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at the life of taxidermist Carl Akeley. Plus, how much online marketers know about your personal life? Do we need a do not track button for the internet? That's all on the next Science Friday from NPR.
Science Friday this afternoon from 2 until 4, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend begins with host Christopher Purdy and a discussion of arts and culture in Central Ohio. With CATCO Artistic Director Stephen Anderson and Ballet Met Artistic Director Gerard Charles. Join us for All Sides Weekend beginning at 11. 25 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today, a high of 26. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 11 degrees.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Sorry for that lengthy break, but Gail Sheehy and I were talking about stuff, and there's always a lot to talk about with this kind of a thing. Gail, there are, in the labyrinth, is it seven, eight?
Eight.
Mm-hmm. Eight turns.
Eight turns that, if you're on it for the long run. First is shock and mobilization, where you have to become a good reporter. Go into the consults with doctors with a notepad because you're going to hear selectively, and the patient probably isn't going to hear at all, or even a tape recorder. If you let the doctor know that you're willing to do research and you're going to be a collaborative partner with him or her, they'll be much more likely to pay attention to you and help you out down the line. You need to call the local area agency on aging. There's one in every county, maybe one in your city. They're the people who a volunteer or a social worker will answer. They know what the community resources are and who can help you out. They may come home and do a home assessment of your person and whether or not they need to retrofit the home. And then, you know, you might want to get in touch with a geriatric care manager. You can go on to www.eldercarelocator.org. It's a government organization, eldercarelocator.org. Put in your zip code, and you'll get the names of geriatric care managers in your area. And they can help you, you know, give you a short course in how to be a caregiver and how to protect yourself from bureaucratic dead ends. Then, you know, you also, you may want to use visual feedback to train somebody when they're before they go into an operation with guided imagery so that they don't, the body doesn't react to surgery as if there's an assault on the body. And believe it or not, Blue Cross Blue Shield will now pay for you to use guided imagery or give you a credit because it's so helpful in helping people recover from surgery sooner.
When you first heard about that, or at least your husband at first thought, you're kidding me.
Right, I know. Guided imagery and then teach him self-hypnosis. Come on. My husband was not a navel-gazing, om-chanting kind of guy. But I'll tell you, once he learned that, then he could go into a consult that was likely to be very stressful and just do self-hypnosis beforehand and not worry about fainting. And the guided imagery allowed him to come out of surgery with almost no bleeding, to be healed much faster, and it actually turned him on to meditation, and he began meditating regularly, which was enormously helpful. You know, I was a caregiver for my husband off and on for 17 years, so we must have been doing something right because most of that was borrowed time.
We have another call right now from John. John, you want to talk about how things are different for folks who are really stressed about money?
Yeah, that's right. I guess I'd appreciate some comment from Gail Sheehy about the situation that people find themselves in who don't have economic resources very much, and what counsel she would provide for people who can't afford to stay home.
Well, most of us can't afford to stay home. I mean, most people and most couples now, there's are two-income earners. You know, we have to keep working and often into our 70s or longer. The only way I know to do this without resources is A, if you get on Medicaid or get on a Medicaid waiver program called PACE, P-A-C-E, which is widely available, and that can allow you to have a therapists come to the house or aides come to the house, wash and dress your person if they can't, take them to a central treatment location where they can be seen by their doctors and nurses and get social stimulation. The other way is to try to put together, you know, a network of care with your family. I mean, if you don't have siblings, you know, it's not easy. But if you do have siblings, even if they live in different parts of the country, you know, they can take over and do the calls for one day. You know, you can have a website that you share that's private just for your family. And it just, and each day, you know, one person signs off and says, these are the call, follow-up calls that you need to make tomorrow. This is where things are. Okay, you know, tomorrow is Tom's turn. The next day it's Susan's turn. And try to get some friends in on it or coworkers. Companies now are more likely to have some elder help or to allow you to have some flex time because it is essential for most of us to keep working. So you have, you know, a place to go when the caregiving vigil is over, and you have an income and health insurance for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's really important. My perspective is that a really good nursing home facility or retirement home that provides assisted living is just a very important answer for a lot of people, but the the cost involved are really significant, and one must be prepared to use all of one's funds to provide that opportunity.
I know. I bled my financial security severely by providing round-the-clock care for my husband at home for well over a year. In my case, I feel that it was worth it because I continued working. I had to spend down my savings, but because I continued working, I have a career afterwards. And at one point, my husband's geriatrician actually ordered me at my husband's bedside to go out to work and actually to go on the presidential campaign and take advantage of an opportunity I had to write an article for Vanity Fair about Hillary Clinton's campaign. I didn't think I could go. How could I leave my husband? And the doctor stood at my husband's bedside and said, Gail is losing herself.
Yes.
She's a writer. I think I would like to, you know, prescribe that Gail go out on the presidential campaign for 4 days and see if she can still write because she doubts that she can still do what she does. And he said, I want your buy-in, Clay. And Clay said, go, please. I want you to have this. I want you to be a writer. Just come back and give me the news and gossip.
And I, what I thought was interesting about that too, Gail, that story was that you came back and then you know you wrote the story, but then he's an editor through and through, 150% editor, and he worked with you on it.
He worked with me on it. It made him feel so valuable. We were back in that same collaboration we'd had so often. And then one day I came home from, you know, late night closing the story, and he was just so bright and cheerful. I said, "What's going on?" And he said, you told me over the phone that they liked your story.
Great.
John, are you the caregiver?
No, but I'm on the board of several institutions that do provide care, and our dilemma is that it's very difficult to provide really good assisted living unless a person has economic resources for it. And I think your whole life needs to prepare for these kinds of issues. It's not enough to do it at the close of your life. And I think couples really need to talk about this all along the way and the financial ramifications of it.
Absolutely. That's, you know, I didn't get through all those turnings, but the turning before the turnings on the labyrinth of caregiving is having that conversation about who will take care of whom and how will we provide for it. And I felt very foolish at not having seen this passage coming because, after all, I'm the lady who wrote passages. And, you know, we weren't kids. I was in my 50s. My husband was in his 60s. We should have seen it coming. But if you don't, and then once you get it through shock and mobilization, you may think, oh, whew, okay, everything is all set now. We've got it all in place. You enter the new normal. You think, okay, I can do this. But sooner or later, there's likely to be a boomerang, another health crisis. You know it better. You can handle it better. But if you start handling it too well, you're likely to move into playing God, which
That's
I mentioned
right.
before, right?
Well.
Then you're taking on too much. And then you will eventually get to the turning called, I can't do this anymore. And you're close to burning out, if not there. those calls that go into caregiving hotlines usually don't come until 3 or 4 years down the line. That's too long.
Yes, it is.
Right? So then if you do begin to get help, and at that point there are a lot of ways you can get help, and you can get respite. You can get respite through palliative care or hospice care, and you need to take it. And then you move into what I call the in-between stage, which we covered before, where your person can't really be cured in an acute care hospital, but they're not ready for hospice. And now, you know, palliative care is one solution, or assisted living, or nursing home. And then you finally get to the long goodbye. And even though that's a sad time, it's also the most intimate time, even with a parent from whom you might have been estranged. And it's a time when the patient can give back, as one of the earlier callers told. Often the patient will be able to say, I want you to go on. What are you going to do? And you may say, well, I'm just going to stay here with you, you know, until you get better. And the generous patient will say, I'm not going to get better, but I want you to have a life after I'm gone. So what's your care plan for yourself?
That's right. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think people are prepared to talk. The patient's prepared to talk seriously, and we need to listen to them carefully.
Yes, we do. Thank you.
John, thanks so much for your call. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Bye.
We have a few more minutes left, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a comment from Bob on email. He writes, I am a Meals on Wheels driver. Meals on Wheels offers a little bit of respite for caregivers. Can you talk about how these kinds of programs can help relieve the caregiver?
Oh, there's nothing better than having meals delivered. And my mother used to do that when she was in her later years. There's also the possibility of getting together a circle of care of friends who will bring a meal or a meal service, and everybody chips in to have meals bought. Because if at the end of the day, especially, if a caregiver doesn't have to also think about shopping and preparing dinner, they can actually, you know, take a nap or take an hour for themselves. So providing meals is probably one of the greatest substances. It's also a social experience.
Mm-hmm.
So actually providing a meal and then sitting there with the person and eating it would be the best gift of all.
We have a fantastic Meals on Wheels program here. It's called Life Care Alliance. Kate, you're on the air with Gail Sheehy.
Yes. Excuse me. Nothing has been said about support groups, and I think that's terrifically important, particularly for cancer patients and their caregivers, whether the caregivers, somebody actually in the house, which I was not when I had this role, or living separately. Mm-hmm. And to go particularly to something like the wellness community where they deal with cancer patients and have a support group and a caregivers group that
yes.
meets at the same time is particularly useful.
Very helpful. Also, I would say there's the Well Spouses Association where well spouses get together and talk about, you know, being in a different kind of life from the life that they see in the sick room, and offer each other a lot of support and inspiration. And I totally agree with you. Support groups are a wonderful way, and there are support groups online now because people are maybe not free to get out at a particular time. So any way you can do it is good.
And then of course the hospitals have programs. I haven't participated in any of those, but I'm now on the mailing list to get that stuff. And let me mention just one other little thing. Have the business of maybe taking a tape recorder to a doctor's appointment, take one of those mini recorders to every doctor's appointment you have to go to. You find out, excuse me, you find out things that you don't remember being said at
Absolutely.
All, or you remember it wrong, you
right.
didn't get it written down in your notes,
mm-hmm.
take the little recorder, listen to it at least once, erase it then. If you don't need to keep it, it's mm-hmm. a wonder.
I agree. And I'll tell you, I didn't find out doctors objecting because they know you're not going to hear it all, and you're just going to be calling their nurse and bugging them for
yeah.
the answers they've already given you.
Yeah, they do. They appreciate it, I think.
That's a great idea, Kate. Kate, thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. We have another, just time for one more phone call. And Dale, you have a personal experience with your wife. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Yeah. In regard to what it is, I lost my wife after 2.5 years of metastatic cancer. Hmm. And before the last procedures, which were basically experimental, I went to my doctor and asked a second opinion. Now, you taught at medicine at OSU Medical School and just dabbled in family practice, so I had a lot of respect for him. And we went. He said, I'll get the test results. Come back. I came back. He came back, and he said, this is probably the only thing that can be done now. It's necessary. And he asked her, was she afraid to die? And she calmly said, no. And he asked her, what are you afraid of? And she broke down, and we both broke down. And as it turns out, she was more concerned about what happened to her two adult children, 20-somethings, and myself. Mm-hmm. She was more concerned about her family, mm-hmm. what would happen to them than, you know.
That's the most common thing that people are worried about. And I think that we as caregivers or adult children can, you know, anticipate that and try to reassure a parent that, you know, we can carry on our own, even if you don't believe it at the
yeah.
time.
I don't. Your comment about playing God, I may or may not have, because at one point I was actually working two jobs, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and that I was she didn't drive, never has, but she had a lead foot, so I believed her. mm-hmm. I was taking her to both ends of town, you know, downtown at OSU and then the chemo up north, and every 20 minutes I would wake up just to make sure she was breathing, because my mm-hmm. worst fear was that I would lose her while I was sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Dale, thank you so much for your call. We're running out of time. And
okay.
Thank you for joining our show.
Have a good one.
Take care. Gail Sheehy, you're going to be speaking for the Transition Network.
And we're going to be talking about good times. I had some wonderful times, some of the most wonderful times in my marriage in the 17 years I was taking care of my husband, because we knew every day was precious.
We didn't get to that, but thank you for adding that. Gail, thank you so much for joining our show today.
My pleasure.
Gail Sheehy, author of Passages and Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.